Transportation Policy and Finance Committee meeting for February 21st will come to order. We do have a quorum, members, and so the clerk will note the roll. Actually, the our assistant committee administrator will note the roll. We have in front of us the minutes of the last meeting. Looking for a motion on those?
Mr. Chairman, I'd move that we accept the minutes of the last meeting.
Representative Benson moves the minutes. Is there further discussion, comments, corrections? Seeing none, members, let's vote. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Thank you. We've adopted the minutes. Members, we have a bill before us today that we will hear and take action on. If it passes the committee, we will re-refer it to the Committee on Ed Finance. Representative Howes is the author of the bill, and I'd like to ask Representative Leidiger, do you want to move the bill? Move that it be recommended pass referred to the Committee on Ed Finance. And it's House File 392.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move House File 392, the School Bus Crossing Control Arms bill, and I'd like to move that to be held over.
No, re-referred to the Committee on Ed Finance.
Re-referred
that's
to
your
the
motion.
Committee on Ed Finance.
Representative Howes, welcome to the committee. Would you like to take a few moments and explain your bill? And
we'll Mr. Chairman.
Pepper you with questions. Representative Leidiger.
Yes, sir. Before we start, just point of personal privilege.
Well,
we have guests, and I just wanted to recognize the guests, please, sir.
Yeah, please.
We have behind me the troop from Watertown, Boy Scout Troop 209 from Watertown, and I'd like to welcome them to the Transportation Committee.
Ben, welcome.
They're going to be leaving soon. I wanted to get that in, sir. Well,
Representative Leidiger, thank you for calling that to our attention. Okay. Representative Howes, now we'll let you tee up your bill and we'll discuss it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. What this bill would do is require all new buses after January 1st, 2012 to have a school crossing arm on the front bumper that would extend forward. The reason for moving this bill is I did have a young boy in my district, I believe it was about a year and a half ago, that somehow got in front of the bus and the driver didn't see him and he was run over. And it's not the only time it's happened in my area. And just for your reference, last year after I introduced the bill, in traveling the greater metropolitan area, either be 94 Snelling Avenue or Rice Street or anywhere in St. Paul, 80% of the buses that I saw in St. Paul had a crossing arm in the front. And it was spread all over, private buses or actual school buses, different companies. It was pretty common. But in northern Minnesota, it's not common at all. And so that's why I'm looking to do this statewide. And I have Mr. Kelleher with me here today. And we can answer any questions you might have.
Brief explanation of the bill. Any questions from members before we go to Mr. Kelleher to speak to the bill? Mr. Kelleher, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, good morning. My name is Tom Kelleher. I'm representing the Minnesota School Bus Operators Association. We introduced this bill last year, and it was actually a section of the education policy bill last year, which for a lot of reasons did not pass, not because of this particular section. We feel that this is a proactive decision by our group to help alleviate transportation tragedies that basically occur when you're transporting students who, as you all recall being students, are bouncy little people and they do student things, kid things. As you can see from the front of this desk, the school bus hood on a school bus is about twice the size of this. I had an occasion to be in front of some school buses, brand new school buses, a couple months ago. They come right up to my shoulder and I'm about 6 feet tall. I'm about 6'4". So if you've got the elementary school student in front of that bus and the student is too close, that the driver cannot see over the hood. And what this does, it's a very inexpensive, there's about $300 to $350 per bus for a new bus is what we're talking about, I think it's an 8-foot arm that comes out, from the right, opening to the left. Causes the student to have to pass so far in front of the bus that the driver has eyesight. We feel that this is an inexpensive tool to help us keep students safe. And as I said, we do not want to have this caused on old buses. We have a standing policy about retrofitting. There's a lot of people who want to do retrofits on school buses, and that gets very expensive. But on a new school bus is about $80,000 to $95,000. So a $300 option to put a crossing arm on the front is very minuscule price. And we're just talking about that's a great methodology to try to help keep students more safe.
Thank you. Questions for the testifier or the author of the bill? Before, Mr. Representative Vogel, you have a question?
Yes, I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. One question I have is, how many buses, it says here that for all buses manufactured in Minnesota. Now, am I reading that right?
Manufactured for use. Mr.
Right.
Kellen,
all manufactured for use in Minnesota. So it doesn't matter where they're manufactured at, right? So wherever they're manufactured, they have to. Okay. I just want to make sure of that.
I just have a couple of clarifying follow-up questions before we pass your bill, Representative House. First of all, I'm surprised this was not already the law because, as you've noted, all the buses in the district where I am that I've ever seen have not only the sweep arm, they also have the fisheye lens that hangs out over the front of the hood. Would this pertain to those as well, or just the sweeping arm? And what do we call that arm? There's a name for it.
It's a crossing arm, Mr. Chairman. Okay. The crossing arm is what the uniform term is for it. Mm-hmm. The stop arm is the stop sign that comes out on the left
side. Yeah.
That seems to be the predominance of violations that mechanism is not connected to the door opening. So the driver has to open the door and do the crossing arm mechanism.
How about the mayor?
Mr. Chairman, the other part of your question was, isn't this already in current law? And it's not. Representative Lynn Carlson and Representative Kahn thought it was because they had dealt with this issue many, many years ago. Mm-hmm. But probably like what happened to this bill last year, it was in a bill at one time, but it didn't survive the process. And I think everybody dropped the ball and just thought it had happened.
Okay. Perhaps that's what I'm recalling as well. And one last question, Mr. Kelleher?
Oh, just one quick comment that a lot of the school districts put it in their contracts with their bus operators.
Okay.
And I should preface that I represent the independent bus operators. Mm-hmm. The school boards, the school districts themselves operate about half the buses. The people I operate the other half of the buses. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the school districts put in their contracts that the buses must have a crossing arm on the front of their buses.
Thank you for the clarification. Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kelleher, it would appear to me one of the unforeseen consequences of this would be a bus pulling up close to a crosswalk and this javelin shooting out and forcing the child out of the crosswalk. Any concerns with this?
Mr. Kelleher.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Biskins, I don't know that it's a javelin-like device. It's a piece of plastic, more or less, that has a reinforced slice of metal in it. I think you could snap it in half with your hands.
Mr. Chair, and Mr. Kelleher, thank you for clarifying that. Yeah, one could say it's a hurdle for a kid to jump over too, but that's not the point I'm trying to make here, and so I hope we can focus on more the more important point of a bus pulling up close to a crosswalk with this arm sweeping out and therefore forcing the child out of the crosswalk and into active lanes of traffic. Is there any guidance for bus operators? Is there special training for bus operators? Yeah, I'd hate to mandate this on every bus and find out that we end up with more injuries to children than not having these at all, and rather than simply the concave mirror or the convex mirror.
Mr. Kelleher or Representative House?
Chairman, I'll take this one, Representative Biskins. To the best of my knowledge, and I have researched it, but I haven't gone into the great detail that you do on occasion, but I can tell you that there's no history of a child running beyond the arm into an intersection and out of the crosswalk and becoming injured. So I would assume, and I think rightfully so, that our bus drivers are very well trained, and they know where to stop. They have good depth perception, or they wouldn't be licensed to drive a bus. So I feel very confident that our bus drivers will stop at the proper distance from the crosswalk to allow our students to stay in the crosswalk.
And Mr. Chairman.
Representative Biskin.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Representative Howes. And I would concur that our bus drivers are very well trained. However, with any profession, to make a blanket statement that everyone is very well trained never pans out. The other question I have then is, if there has been research done, could you tell me what other states have this mandate?
Mr. Kelleher or Representative Howes, either one.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Biskins, I knew someone was going to answer that question. I couldn't find out the answer to that. As I said earlier, the predominance of the Twin Cities districts, to my knowledge, the school boards themselves put in the bus contract that they must have these crossing arms on buses. So in order to be a vendor for those school districts, the school districts say you got to have a crossing arm on the front of your bus. In the state now, it's voluntary, but a lot of school districts have determined that they feel it's an important safety measure and are including it in their vendor contracts.
Yeah. Well, Mr. Chairman, and to that point...
Oh, wait. Representative House.
Yeah, to that point, I'm not really interested in what other states are doing. I'm interested in what we do to protect our children, and also not interested in other states us following suit. Well, there aren't any other states that are raising taxes except ours. So I don't follow what other states do necessarily. I think that the children's safety is far outweighs anything other states are doing.
Representative Biskin,
well, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Representative Howes. I know if it saves one life, it's worth whatever expense we can extort out of the taxpayers' pockets. But I do believe in the concept of federalism and why we have the 50 learning labs, so we can learn from each other. Mr. Chairman, my only concern with Minnesota mandating this on all buses is that much like other mandates that we have put on automobiles, when we are the first out of the chute, the state that is the first out of the chute typically incurs all of the manufacturing expenses that they must go through to meet that mandate. It sounds like that might not be an issue here, it sounds like most bus manufacturers already have the equipment necessary, but I do think prudence is always the better part of valor.
Prudence, a good virtue. Representative Schmansky.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Mr. Kelleher. The question that I have was the liability insurance carriers for the transportation providers, the school bus operators. Do they weigh in on this issue as well to recommend the crossing arm be provided on their buses that they're insuring?
Mr. Kelleher?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Schmansky, I have not heard one way or the other since I called my insurance carrier this morning because I had a little calamity with my truck in my garage yesterday because of the weather. I can get them back on the phone and ask, but I do not think that there is a discount for having a crossing arm on the front of a bus. I mean, I think the people I represent would love to have a discount for having a crossing arm on the front of the buses, but I don't know one way or the other.
Okay. I understand there might be someone that wants to testify to the contrary on this legislation. Anybody else want to testify for or against the bill before we... Well, that's unfortunate. I was looking forward to that encounter.
Me too, Mr. Chair.
Okay, further questions of the testifier or the bill's author before we pass this on to state government or education finance? Members, seeing none, Representative Leidiger renews his motion that House File 392 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Ed Finance. All in favor signify by aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails and the bill is passed to Ed Finance.
Thank
Representative
you,
House, you're welcome. Members, next on our agenda, we're going to hear from our friends at the Metropolitan Airport Commission. Mr. Jeff Hamill, the Executive Director. And Jeff, who are you bringing with you today? By yourself? Well, you got backup if you need to phone a friend then.
You got it.
Okay, good deal. Now, members, do we have this handout in our packets here? I don't see it. We can follow along on the overhead PowerPoint. It's working in this room. It wasn't working earlier in room 200. So, Mr. Hamill, welcome to the committee and proceed when you are ready.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. Members, I'm Jeff Hamill, the Executive Director of the Metropolitan Airports Commission. Here to talk to you today about the MAC and its background and answer questions that you may have. I have to start off by saying that it's a pleasure to be here early in the legislative session because it gives us an opportunity to talk about the airport as opposed to meeting all of you when there's an issue that comes before you of some concern. We can provide you some background and so forth that I think is a very good way of communicating a little bit about the MAC and what we try to do. So thank you very much for the invitation to be here.
You're welcome.
What I'd like to do is talk a little bit about just about structure of airports a little bit, starting to become a broad national perspective, and then bring it down to the MAC itself, talk about our board members, talk about some of our governance, talk about our finances, talk about how we operate our system, and talk about really our airports a little bit to kind of give you a snapshot over the next 20 minutes or so. And then if you have any questions at all during the presentation or at the end, certainly I'm available to answer any questions you may have. To start off with, from a national perspective, there are 29 large hub airports in the United States. To qualify as a large hub airport in the U.S., you have to transport at least 1% of all the passengers in a given year. And that number fluctuates from 29, 30, 31 hub airports. Given the current economic cycle and so forth, we now have 29 large hub airports, and Minneapolis St. Paul International Airport is one of those 29 large hubs. We rank about number 12th or 13th. And that number fluctuates up and down depending on total passengers and total operations or takeoffs and landings. The ownership or the management of airports basically focuses on locally owned and operated through local government units. But that may vary. For example, some airports are operated and owned by cities. Some airports are operated by counties. There are airports like the MAC, which is a commission created by the legislature. And then some places, the states actually operate airports. To give you some examples of airports that would be operated by cities, Atlanta-Hartsfield Airport, one of the largest airports in the country, is a city-operated airport. The city of Chicago operates the Chicago O'Hare Airport. From the standpoint of county, Los Angeles World Airport System is a county airport system, as is the Miami-Dade County Airport Authority in Miami, Florida. A couple of examples of state systems would be the Maryland. State of Maryland operates the Baltimore Airport. The state of Hawaii operates Honolulu. We in Minneapolis and St. Paul operate independently, as does, for example, Detroit, which is one of our key competing airports up in the upper Midwest.
Mr. Hamill?
Yes, sir.
Representative Benson has a question for you.
Perfect timing, I hope, because we're talking about who owns the airports and the like. But from what I understand, there's an opportunity for the program through the federal government to actually privatize airports.
Yes.
And that Midway, in fact, was the one that was first designated as the one that we're going to, and that's since fallen away. You know, in Europe, there are many airports that have been privatized. Are we given any thought to, I mean, there's some real advantages, some money involved here. In fact, the deal for Midway was worth about $2.5 billion over a 99-year lease. Have we given any thought to that?
We have. It's a complicated issue, and to kind of give you just a snapshot overlook, and then we can talk in more detail if you wish later. The federal government has been requested to make available a cross-section of airports, large and medium hub airports, that could be considered for privatization. And what they have done is authorized a certain number of airports, including Chicago's Midway Airport, to be kind of a model or a pilot project to see, in fact, how that process works. And the concept is pretty straightforward. If a public agency operates an airport, the question then becomes, is local government the best party to manage and operate these airports, or in fact could a private enterprise acquire the airport, purchase the airport from the local municipality, buy it over a long period of time, and then operate it in more of a private sector sort of a mode. And what's happened thus far is there are a couple of private airports that are smaller airports that have attempted this, not particularly successfully in the past. Chicago Midway is probably the most visible airport in the United States at the present time, and there have been two opportunities where they've tried to privatize, but because of either financing mechanisms falling through or a shift in the economy, the first two attempts to privatize Chicago Midway have not been successful. That, however, is not over with, and that model is going to be looked at further because there's another reorganizing attempt at the present time for financiers to go ahead and take a look at putting the model together again and try to acquire it from the City of Chicago.
Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Would we be in part of that process in terms of making application to be considered?
We are not at the present time. Yeah. It's not a matter of applying. It's more of a matter of the government, the federal government, determining which airports are most likely candidates for this kind of a model pilot project. We, however, in the future, could be definitely considered a part of that mechanism, yes.
Mr. Representative Benson.
Excuse the pun, but are we on the radar?
Mr. Hamilton. We would be on the radar if we were to take an aggressive action to appeal after the Chicago Midway project has been pilotized, and if it's in fact a successful model, or whatever happens with it over the course of time, we could be in that role. We're well known in Washington. The FAA knows us well. We could put our name on a list for future consideration.
Thank you. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know that Mr. Hamill probably wants to get through his presentation, but while we're on this topic, I did want to at least weigh in. And, you know, as much of a challenge as I think we've had on issues of pollution and noise, to privatize the airport would, I think, be very, very problematic from that standpoint, because at least we have a publicly accountable agency, to deal with some of these issues that my district addresses, and I think there's a variety of consumer issues, and so I hope, Mr. Hamill, that you will be very, very cautious, and I think it would be a real big problem to go down that road for many reasons, but I think we have some environmental and consumer and labor concerns, among others, that there's a big flashing red light goes off for me on the topic of privatization, so I just wanted to weigh in on that while it was on the table.
Mr. Chairman, members,
Mr. Hamill.
I think an important element that needs to be understood is, and I think you pointed to it a moment ago in your question, around the world, airports are privatized fairly commonly. All the European airports are privatized, and many of the airports in Asia are privatized. Mm-hmm. But there's a reason for that. Mm-hmm. Europe and Asian governments do not permit local government to sell bonds to finance capital projects, and which means that they don't have access to capital markets, sell bonds, generate the revenue necessary to expand facilities. In the U.S., large hub airports are authorized to sell bonds. We can have access to capital markets and investors, and as a result, we don't have a problem financing major capital improvements. Other parts of the world, it's a very, very different scenario. So other places have been driven to a private sector sort of a model, where in the United States, that has not been the case. The one management privatization effort was Indianapolis, Indiana, where British Airports Authority acquired management rights to the Indianapolis Airport. They promised to return to the city of Indianapolis $25 million at the end of the contract, and in fact believed that they could reduce manpower, improve efficiencies in Indianapolis to provide a much more competitive airport. The result, however, was that well short of 25 years, they were not able to generate the revenues. They were not able to reduce the staff. They ended up having to pay a penalty and paid off the obligation of the $25 million to the city of Indianapolis, and they left the contract early, about 5 or 7 years early. So it's not a fair example because, quite frankly, it's an early model. It was kind of the first attempt. But in the United States, we historically have not been very successful at privatizing airports, except for very small airports with very specialized purposes. But it certainly is something we should take a look at. At the staff level, we've briefly talked about this and indicated we should take a look at all ways of managing these assets. And I think as my comments progress this morning, you'll learn that we, in fact, do a lot of things that the private sector does do, and it keeps our airport quite competitive.
Mr. Hamill, Representative Benson, you have a follow-up to
just
that?
Just a statement. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mm-hmm. And Representative Hornstein, we'll have plenty of time to maybe debate this whole thing later. But it is true that many or most, if not all, in Europe, and they would have the same kind of consideration. I've flown in Europe, and they're all in metropolitan areas that are as busy or if not busier than Minneapolis-St. Paul. And they have issues of noise that they've had to work with and pollution and so on. So I guess, we're a state that's also looking for ways that we can produce more revenue and money. And in those instances, at least, they've improved quality and revenue to the state. So My hope is that we would spend some time actually at least taking a look and exploring the avenues or opportunities. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, we are looking at Chicago's Midway Airport. That's our closest neighbor, and we'll watch that experiment, that model, that pilot project progress, and we will discuss and we'll learn more about it as time progresses.
Well, perhaps, Mr. Hamill, as your presentation progresses today, you give a brief history of where the Metropolitan Airports Commission came from, why it was constituted, how many airports you run, how you generate your revenue, and where your competitive pressures come from, what you're actually trying to do when you run the airport system. I'm sure you're going to get to that here in a few moments. So,
Mr. Chairman, right now.
Okay, good deal.
The Metropolitan Airports Commission was actually created by you, the Minnesota Legislature, in 1943. If you go back historically, at that time, Governor Stassen basically saw the upper Midwest as being the center or the middle of the North American continent. And back in those days, following and during the latter part years of the war, we all learned that international or oceanic transportation was becoming reliable. The perfection of the aircraft engines and the reliability of these aircraft, going from canvas-covered stick models to well-constructed and engineered aircraft, demonstrated that aviation was on the edge of leaping forward in a significant way. And what basically Governor Stassen did at the time was recommend that we create an airports commission, which ended up being the first commission in the state of Minnesota, to basically focus on a single purpose, and that would be providing a safe and efficient air transportation network that would connect Minneapolis-St. Paul to major destinations within the domestic system, as well as promote international air transportation into worldwide markets and connect Minnesota and the Twin Cities greater metropolitan area to the world marketplace. And in fact, it has worked extremely well. Being the first commission, we are a single purpose. Our only focus is to provide safe air transportation to meet the community's needs. And we've, I think, done that fairly well for the most part. Our structure consists of 15 commissioners. Of the 15 commissioners, the governor of the state appoints 13 of those seats. Of the 13 seats, one seat is the chairman's seat, and that chairman is appointed as chair by the governor. In fact, Governor Dayton just appointed Commissioner Dan Boven, who represented the city of Minneapolis, who sits in the seat of the mayor, R.T. Rybak. And he is now becoming the chair of the Metropolitan Airports Commission, and Jack Lanners is now no longer serving as chair. But he was appointed 5 years ago by Governor Pawlenty to fill the vacant position of the chair. Our commissioners, of the 13 that are appointed by the governor, one is the chair. The other 12 seats appointed by the governor are 8 metro area seats and 4 greater Minnesota outstate seats. Our metro district is basically 7-county metro area. So for every 2 metropolitan council districts, we have 1 MAC district. So they have 16 commissioners. We have 8 in the metro area. They all serve staggered 4-year terms, except for the chairman, who serves at the pleasure of the governor. So what we end up having is not a complete overhaul or exchange every time there's an election. With Governor Dayton coming into office, it's an unusual turnover. We now have 6 commissioner seats plus the chair vacant. That's unusual. A couple of unusual things happened. One was the resignation of one of our board members because they ran for public office in Anoka County. They were successful, and he felt that he could no longer serve both bodies because we both have an interest in the Anoka County Airport. But normally, under a normal transition, the commission sees 2 or 3 and possibly 4 seat changes with the change of a governor. Each subsequent year, however, 2 or 3 commissioners leave, and the governor has the opportunity to appoint 2 or 3 additional people, so that you have continuous continuity. People can share ideas and thoughts, and the programs don't take these huge swings based on a complete house clean of our board. It's a well-run organization from the standpoint that we have been extremely fortunate in that we, in our almost 70 years, have had some extraordinary people serve on our board. People who come to the Metropolitan Airports Commission don't necessarily come to us as Democrats or Republicans. Air transportation, aviation is pretty consistently a nonpartisan issue for the most part. We might get into more detail on finances with one group versus the other, but at the end of the day, everyone wants safe, efficient, competitive air transportation. We want low prices. We want a well-maintained facility. It's a huge public investment, and as a result, it has to be managed well. And we've had some extraordinarily strong leadership within our board and some very, very active and participating board members. And that's been one of the secrets to our success over all of the years. I'll talk about governance in a few minutes so you can kind of get a sense of the time commitment and so forth. Looking at the organization itself from the standpoint of employees, we have 574 employees that work at the MAC on a full-time basis. That makes it one of the smallest, if not the smallest, employee composition of any large hub airport in the United States. I'm the executive director of the commission, so I basically serve as its CEO of sorts. If you take a look at our structure given to us by you as a commission, you could look at our chairman as a mayor of a city or a community, look at our board members as council members. I would be the city administrator, and our staff, of course, would be the various departments you'd find in any city. And the structure is very similar to that. We have the authority from you to pass ordinances and make laws. We have our own police department. We have our own fire department. We have our own public works department. We call it field maintenance for the most part. We have plumbers, electricians, carpenters, the whole cadre of individuals you would see in any kind of a city structure or organization. That structure works extremely well, and it gives us a sense of autonomy because our board members don't represent specific cities. I told you we had 15 members. We talked about the 13. Also on our board serves the mayor of Minneapolis and the mayor of St. Paul to give the two major cities some input into the decision-making process. Neither of the two current mayors, nor has a mayor for the last probably 10 or 15 years, served personally. They've always had a representative in their seat on their behalf. But there's good dialogue, there's good exchange. We don't always come to easy decisions and so forth, but we all have the same goal in mind, which is to provide a safe and efficient air transportation system.
Mr. Hamill, when you liken yourself to a city, I think it's a very apt description. You also have the ability to bond and to levy taxes as well.
We do.
Care to speak about those briefly?
We do have the authority to levy bonds. We do an analysis of our bonding needs based on capital improvements that are projected for the airport to meet growth and demand. And we enjoy one of the highest and strongest bond ratings in the nation. We have a double A minus bond rating for MAC bonds. There are only a few airports in the country that have that level of authority from both S&P, Moody's, and Fitch's, Moody's, and S&P. So we've got a financial model that's been analyzed consistently and frequently every time we've issued bonds, and the result is that we've gotten a very, very positive reflection from the financial community regarding our financial management. As far as our ability to raise taxes, going back to the early inception, the commission was given the authority to request or issue a one-third of a mill on all the property, real property in the Twin Cities Seven County metro area. We have not exercised that authority since, I think, the mid-1960s, and all of our financial modeling today is basically focused around avoiding to have to ever go into that tax authorization that we have. I suppose it's good to say it's a backup to have if something really catastrophic were to happen, but we financially model the airport and our needs fairly conservatively, and as a result, protect ourselves from ever having to go to the taxpayer to help us or supplement us with our finances. I'm kind of jumping a bit here to answer your question, but what you need to understand first and foremost is that the Metropolitan Airports Commission does not come to the legislature asking for appropriations. We do not get any general tax revenue or support from the Minnesota legislature through you or from the citizens of the state. If you're a citizen in Minnesota and you never drive to the airport to park your car, pick up someone, go in the terminal building, or buy a ticket, not a penny of your general tax dollar comes to support this operation. It goes back to the privatized model we talked about earlier, and that is the Airports Commission has to generate the revenues every year to meet our financial obligations. That means to pay for the operation of the facility, pay off our debt obligation, and secure our finances. We do that by charging the users of our facility fees to come on the airport. And I'll talk about that in greater detail in just a few moments. But the reality is that we basically charge anyone who uses the airport, from the passenger or the visitor or the airline or the concessions in the building. That's how we generate the revenue on the airport system. Annual revenues of the airport are about $250 million a year. And all of that comes from people who use the facility.
So now, when you say facility, you mean plural. Because you actually control
seven
airports.
We have a system of, that's right. We have a system of seven airports in the Twin Cities metropolitan area. In addition to Minneapolis, St. Paul International Airport, we have a group of airports called reliever airports. And if I may, Mr. Chairman, I'll just put that off to the latter part because I do want to talk about the relievers and their important role in the Twin Cities. I need to change the slide. What this representation shows you are the districts in the metropolitan Southern County area and the composition of our board members. And that way you can kind of see the districts and how they are spread throughout the metropolitan community. And it shows you more clearly the 12 commission seats plus the governor's appointment for chairman, and also then the two mayors' involvement on our board. Wrapping up this concept of MAC looking like a small city, we also work cooperatively with all the communities around the airport. We have mutual aid agreements with all of the surrounding communities, so that, in fact, if there's a problem on the airport where we need additional assistance, police and fire, whatever the case may be, we can call for assistance from those communities, and they will respond. And in kind, we do the same as well. If they have a problem that they cannot deal with, we will respond to their needs as well. And so we have a good deal of exchange with our police departments mutually, less so with our fire departments because we have very specialized equipment, but it's all there and available. An example would be our mutual aid is important to us from the standpoint of if we were to have a major structural fire on the airport, we do not have some of the high extension firefighting equipment available on the airport. It's expensive, and we don't have that many tall facilities where we need and justify the investment. So what we do is through mutual aid, we would request the city of Minneapolis to respond with their equipment. They could send it down and assist us. Likewise, if there was an aircraft incident result in an aircraft ending up in a community near the airport, we would send our crash fire rescue equipment out to take care of that fire and help control the scene and minimize the damage. Those are very important agreements and respecting for one another's assets and facilities in a sharing way so that we can factor in meet any need that would arise. When I talk about our employees, we had our own fire department, our own police department, our field maintenance folks. We also have a small staff, and the staff is small because unlike most government, and I don't mean this in a negative way, but unlike most government, we do an awful lot of outsourcing of services. For example, the cleaning contract in our terminal building, we could, in fact, hire cleaners in the facility that would be the janitors and the janitresses and so forth to take care of all the maintenance in the facility. But what we do is we bid that competitively, and we outsource that work because, quite frankly, it changes consistently and we have changing needs. And rather than assume the burden of having full-time workforce doing that, we actually contract that out to local businesses who provide those kinds of services. And we do that in a whole variety of services, from janitorial services in the facility to architectural design and so forth. We don't have a whole team of architects and engineers on our staff. We have people who are engineers and who are designers and architects who oversee the work of folks that we subcontract to out of the private sector. That gives us an opportunity to have flexibility so that when we have high demand, we can pull people in with the talent and the skills and pay them for their services. And when that demand is minimized or reduces, we don't have to worry about laying people off. We can simply not retain those outside sources, but we'll always have to have on our staff appropriate people who can manage and oversee these activities. So it ends up being a very competitive airport from the standpoint of generating our own revenues, paying our own bills, deciding where to subcontract out for competitive services, and getting the lowest cost we can for projects. Let's turn for a few minutes to governance and oversight of the commission from the standpoint internally of the MAC. We are structured with committees on our board. We have three major committees: the Management Operations Committee, the Finance, Development, and Environment Committee of the Commission, and the Human Resources Committee. Each commissioner who is appointed to our board serves on at least one of those committees, and they meet typically the first Wednesday of each month, and they meet nearly every month. I think maybe we've had one committee not meet once during the year because the agenda didn't require it. But basically, all commissioners plan on coming to the airport 2 days out of the month to attend their committee meeting and then the full board commission meeting for decision and authorization. What's important to understand is that our committees, are pretty thorough. That's where the discussion takes place. That's where the real debate takes place. That's where we see an awful lot of the challenge to the staff, thorough information, strong background, and so forth. And then they make a recommendation. That recommendation then goes to the full board on the third Monday of every month. So every commissioner comes to the airport, the Lindbergh Terminal Facility, Terminal 1, and they basically have a chance to be exposed to the facility, look around, have lunch typically during the breaks and so forth, and basically make a decision at the committee level and a recommendation of the board for final action. So they're all pretty engaged and pretty regularly coming to the facility to make certain that they are connected to the airport and understand its operational needs and how it serves the community. We also work with outside groups. We have a Noise Operations Committee. We have the Reliever Airport Advisory Commission. We have the Flying Cloud Advisory Committee. We basically work with folks that have citizen groups that have been organized to work with us to communicate concerns and interests. And I have staff assigned to work with those committees on a regular basis. And they meet monthly or quarterly depending on the need and the issue at the time. But the bottom line is that we do enjoy transparency. We do want citizens to participate. All of our meetings, of course, are public. And we make an accommodation if everyone come to the airport and not be charged to park to come to a public meeting. And we provide passes to give access to our facility so they can join us in our committee meetings. All right. I alluded to our finances a little while ago, and I said that basically it's a user pay system. And what's important to understand here is that everyone who uses the airport, and I'll start with the airlines, have to pay to use the facility. Now, kind of a quick snap example. When you land a commercial airliner on the airport, they pay about $1.50 per 1,000 pounds of landed weight. A typical airliner weighs about 150,000 pounds, so for every landing, we somewhere in the area of $200 and $250 per landing for an average commercial jet aircraft. When that aircraft comes into the ramp and parks on the ramp at the gate, they pay to park the aircraft on that piece of concrete that the aircraft sits upon. When they load and unload passengers through the gate lobby, they pay a gate lobby fee to rent that facility. They pay a common use fee to walk up and down the concourses. They pay office space rentals. They pay for the ticket counters. They pay for the baggage carousels and claim devices. The airlines pay a whole variety of fees to the airport authority to use those facilities. We make the physical plant available to them. They provide the commercial aircraft, and the two work together very carefully. But that's how we pay some of the debt obligation on the bonds that we issue to make improvements at the airport. There are also other facilities. For example, we own most of the hangars on the Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport, and so we are paid rental fees for those hangars being available to the competitive private industry. In our terminal building, we bid contracts for the various concessions in the building, both food and beverage and retail sales. We get a percentage of those sales. They also pay a square footage rental to the commission for the space they occupy in the terminal building, and also give us minimum annual guarantees of income on most agreements or contracts. So the concessionaires all pay. And by the way, I want to point out that we also have pricing mechanism that basically we call street pricing plus 10. And what it means is that a person who's traveling to the airport will not feel gouged if they buy merchandise in an airport because they're kind of a captive audience. But in fact, we could face up to about a 10% premium on an item only because of the cost to bring items and go through the security screening process to sell goods and services at the airport. But generally speaking, we get almost no complaints. We receive almost no complaints from the traveling public about our pricing mechanisms. And in fact, that's how we generate a good part of our revenue.
Mr. Hamill, Representative Benson, next question.
Hey, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll make it quick. Just a short question. That is, how do our user fees, our costs, compare to other metropolitan airports around the nation?
I was going to tackle that next, Representative, but I'll do it now since you've asked.
Okay.
When you take a look at all these various fees, in fact, let me finish going down the list of fees now. I'll answer that question. It'll make more sense. Looking at parking, the largest single source of revenue at the airport is our parking concession. And we generate basically almost $65 million a year in revenues off of parking. Now, what we use that money for is, of course, to pay off the capital debt obligation for the capital improvement. And just give it, put that in context for you, a 5,000-vehicle parking ramp today would run somewhere in the area of about $100 million to build. We currently have parking on the airport for about 22,000 vehicles. So you can see that there's kind of four and a half times that number. Just building a parking ramp is an expensive proposition. But there's also profit margin. We do take revenues from that concession activity, which we consider concession, that you, as the public, use when you come to the airport. And we use that to pay off our obligations on the bonds that were sold to build the facilities. And then also there's some profit that we invest in future construction on the airport. Rental car facilities, the rental car companies pay for their facilities and how they use them. We also get a percentage of their gross sales as well. Ground transportation vehicles, if you operate an off-airport parking facility, if you operate a shuttle bus from Rochester or Duluth or St. Cloud to the Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport, you pay on a per-trip basis to use or come into the airport, drop off, and pick up your passengers. And there are a variety of other miscellaneous sorts of sources as well that we use to generate revenues. Taking a look at the total revenues, you can see the percentage breakout here. About 46% of all of our revenue comes from The parking and concessions, 34% from airline rates and charges, and 20% from other, and that would be utilities and rental of facilities that are not airline related. To your specific question, Representative, regarding how we compare with other airports around the country, the Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport has had a policy goal of being in the lower one-third of the 29 large hub airports as far as overall cost per plane passenger. Cost per plane passenger is a metric that we use, or a performance indicator that we use, all airports use it, to compare ourselves with one another. And this is the cost to an airline company to transport one passenger through our facility. The high end of this cost structure is somewhere in the area of $19 to $20 per passenger. Places like San Francisco, for example, airports have just completed significant new capital improvements and major projects since to drive these cost per plane passenger up. Some of the lower cost airports are anywhere from $1 or $2 to $4 on the lower end. The Minneapolis-St. Paul National Airport is at about $6.21 per passenger today, which puts us clearly in the bottom one-third and just one above the bottom one-fourth. Our goal is to maintain a cost-competitive airport that entices or encourages airlines to want to increase and improve service or come here if they currently don't come here. We do not want the price of operating through our airport to be a detracting factor. So we work very, very hard at keeping our costs low. What's even more important to realize is that we've just completed a $3.2 billion expansion program. The $6.21 has factored in that $3.2 billion expense. So even after major capital improvement programs, we're able to maintain this very, very low cost in comparison to some of our competitors. Detroit, for example, is somewhere in around $10.50 per passenger to process someone through. They just finished their major capital program as well. The new midfield terminal, which was built by Northwest Airlines about 7 or 8 years ago, and now the other terminal facilities in the airport that are non-Northwest, non-Delta airline facilities. And that has driven their cost per plane passenger up substantially. We have been able to maintain cost structures in a competitive way and work very hard at that.
Okay.
When you talk about capital improvements, and this goes back to your question of privatization as well, Representative, it costs a lot of money to run an airport. We spend, in the last 10 years, spent between $100 million and $500 million a year on improving the Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport. Now, this does capture the $3.2 billion expansion, which was an extraordinary time in our history. Between 1996 and 2006, we built at the airport expanded terminal facilities, you know, the A and the B and the C concourse, as you may have noticed, significant new parking facilities on the airport. We redid the entire inbound-outbound roadway system. We built the new north-south runway on the west side of the airport. We paid $87 million to drill the tunnels underneath the airport to accommodate the light rail transit system. So we've done a lot of very visible, very significant major capital improvements on the airport. And we were able to issue bonds because of our financial strength to cover the cost of all of these programs. And in fact, that's working out quite well. Another source of revenue for us is the passenger facility charge. We charge every departing passenger. Every is not quite accurate because there may be some circumstances where someone does not pay that if this is their third leg on a 3 or 4 leg trip. But if you're on your first or your second departure leg, we charge $4.50 as a passenger facility charge to every departing person. That $4.50 stays locally in Minneapolis. So, for example, if you're a departing passenger who lives here and you're departing Minneapolis to go to Seattle on business and come back, added to your ticket will be the $4.50. In addition to that, people who are transiting our airport are connecting through the airport, departing from New York, stop in Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Delta to their destination in San Francisco. When they stop at Minneapolis and change planes, they pay an additional $4.50 as well. So everybody who transits our facility contributes to the financial model. This is commonplace throughout the entire large hub system in the United States, and all airports do this. At the present time, the U.S. Congress is debating reauthorization of this bill, and it's being requested by airports to raise that, or have the latitude to raise that to up as high as $7. However, that's very controversial at this time. It may not be very successful. We have other revenues that we generate through our overall operation. I talked about minimum annual guarantees with our concessionaires and so forth. This is how we generate dollars as well. We also participate in the Federal Airport Improvement Program, the AIP program. When you buy an airline ticket, 10% of that ticket is tax. That goes to Washington, D.C., is put into the Aviation Trust Fund. it's important to understand is that this is aviation-generated money staying in an aviation pot that can then be distributed back to the aviation system. These dollars cannot be spent outside of the aviation network. So what we do every year is compete for some of that AIP money, and we probably contribute somewhere in the area of about $30 to $40 million a year into the AIP program as far as tax revenues generated by ticketed passengers from our facilities. We get back somewhere in the area of $15 to $20 million. In years that we have a large capital program, we get more, and some years we have less. But generally speaking, we get back approaching half of the money we contribute. That money is used to support and operate the Federal Aviation Administration, air traffic controllers, inspectors, and so forth. It's also used to fund airport projects for airports that do not have the financial strength that we have as far as passenger activity to pay these fees. So if you're a medium-sized or a small airport needing money to provide passenger support, traffic activity, that helps pay for runways and improvements at smaller airports around the state of Minnesota and, quite frankly, around the nation. And then we also have some revenues that we get from the Minnesota State Airports Fund. That fund is primarily funded from a couple of different mechanisms. I think last week, MnDOT Aeronautics Division was here, and Chris Roy explained to you how they get their revenues. One of those sources is through the fuel tax. The vast majority of the fuel tax is generated off of the Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport. We get some of that money back to do some relatively minor activities, but it's not a substantial number of dollars. So, checking my notes. Let's talk about jobs on the airport. It's a hot topic at the present time, and it's one that we are all looking for the recovery of jobs in our local markets, state markets, as well as the country worldwide or countrywide. The airport, whenever there's a project, generates an awful lot of activity in form of jobs. Talked about the new runway, talked about terminal expansions, talked about all the improvements on the airport. Those are all bid projects, competitively bid to construction companies. When we do a project on the airport, that generates jobs and work for construction companies and all sorts of skilled laborers, as well as designers, engineers, managers, and so forth. And that's an important part of the work that we can generate on an annual basis. As a rule of thumb, if we don't have a capital project, we're just maintaining the facility year after year, we spend between $40 and $50 million a year just on routine maintenance, upgrades and improvements, refurbishing, restoring, repairing, and so forth. That means that we bid a lot of projects every year and a lot of jobs come on the airport. Also, what we end up, when we expand facilities and we build more facilities on the airport, usually it's because the airlines are demanding more facilities, which means more employment, long-term basis. So we not only generate short-term construction jobs and engineering jobs and architectural jobs, but then when the project is completed, the building is occupied by additional employees who work for the airline companies or the various services that support the airline companies. And as a result, we basically provide, I think, a very great opportunity to create jobs and maintain and create new jobs in the state of Minnesota. To give you some numbers, at the present time, there are about 17,000 people that come to work at the Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport every day. Of that 17,000 people, 574 are MAC employees, so where is everybody else? We have the Federal Aviation Administration, the Transportation Security Administration, who does the screening process. We have the airline employees themselves, pilots, flight attendants, reservations people, ticket agents, and so forth. Minnesota has two major reservation centers in the state of Minnesota. And then all the other folks that come to work at the airport who help us maintain our communication systems, our ventilating systems, all of the conveyor systems in our building, all of that is contract work to the private sector, keeping small business and medium-sized businesses actively engaged in our airport operations as well. The bottom line is that 17,000 people come to work every day. That's a major and a significant contribution. Just to give you one thumbnail number, and I won't go into the details, take a look at the jobs, the activity that's generated, all the sales that take place on the airport. The overall economic impact is about in excess of $10 billion a year for all the activities at the airport. And if that's, in fact, anywhere near accurate, that means that the 3,100 acres that the Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport occupies is probably the most valuable piece of real estate between Chicago and Seattle and as far south as St. Louis. There's no other single source site that generates that kind of revenue. And what I say to people on a regular basis is a decision to slow down the airport's growth is a decision to slow the economy of the state and the region. It is a significant generator of economic vitality for the entire state of Minnesota. This picture shows you the 3,100 or 3,200 acre site of the Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport. It is the 12th busiest airport in the United States on average. We have been as high as number 7 and as low as number 15 or 16, fluctuating with the economy, bankruptcies, mergers. All those factors affect this very volatile industry. We are the 16th largest airport in the country as far as passenger traffic goes, and that's a 20% drop from our peak of 2005, just reflecting discretionary dollars and leisure travel cutbacks and businesses becoming more conservative in their travel activities. We are a northern tier airport, which means that we have the cost of moving snow. We all recognize that today. Our friends down in the Florida and Texas markets don't have to deal with that expense. It is a significant expense. But, in fact, even with all these additional expenses of climate, moving snow, all the challenges that we face, the airport is still one of the most economically competitive airports in the United States. The final slide talks about our relief airport system. It's important to us to maintain a healthy and viable relief airport system. 400,000 airplanes a year take off and land on these 6 smaller airports, and I'll identify them for you. I said that we had 7 airports in our system. The other 6 are, in addition to Minneapolis-St. Paul International, St. Paul Downtown Airport, Holman Field. On the east side is the Lake Elmo Airport, a small airport that accommodates small twin-engine, single-engine prop-type aircraft. The Anoka County Airport to the north, corporate jet-type activity down to the small private aircraft. The Crystal Airport, primarily focusing on small prop aircraft. The Flying Cloud Airport in the western suburban areas, this now has a 5,000 runway to accommodate smaller corporate jets and all twin-engine, single-engine prop activity. And to the south, we have the Air Lake Airport in Lakeville. Again, a runway of about 4,000 feet that can accommodate some small jets, but mostly twin-engine prop activity. We call them relievers because what they do is provide an opportunity to operate without congesting the Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport. We encourage corporate jet operators and private flyers to use that outer rim and to choose an airport that's nearest their destination point or their business location. By doing so, we can preserve the capacity of MSP to large capacity airliner category and cargo types of aircraft. What that does is basically distribute the wealth, distributes the operational system, and balances the overall operations of the airport. Quite frankly, it keeps big airplanes and small airplanes separated. However, you have to keep in mind that any time a pilot wishes to land at Minneapolis-St. Paul International, they simply make a radio call on the aircraft radios and ask permission to enter the system, and they'll be given direction to the international airport. No one can be denied a privilege to take off and land from any one of our public airports, but by having such an attractive reliever system, in fact, most folks choose with smaller aircraft to go to the airport that's properly or right-sized for their aircraft needs.
Mr. Hamill.
Mr. Chairman, I'm kind of done talking unless you want to ask a lot of questions.
To the last point, I'm just thinking about the reliever airports and trying to help the members understand how important they are to the system, because when I fly my plane, it's about $2 a minute, maybe a little less. Representative Eakin's plane is probably $1 a minute to fly into St. Paul downtown. And you're exactly right. We're taxpayers. We're pilots. We could fly right into Minneapolis International and taxi right down 10,000 feet of concrete. But remind us what, say, a 757 costs a minute. If he's paddling along behind us waiting for us to get out of the way, what, roughly?
You know, I had a number, Mr. Chairman.
I think it's at least $200 a minute, maybe $300 or $400
a minute. There's a story that has run around this industry for a long time, and I actually heard it up in Duluth when I was flying up there one day with the military. And there was a small single-engine propeller airplane that requested a landing on Duluth's Long Runway, which is an 11,000-foot runway. It's the longest runway in the state of Minnesota. It's a great facility. And there was this little Cessna 150, which is a two-engine passenger airplane with an instructor, and they were on an approach, practicing an instrument approach, simulating weather conditions. And behind them was a Northwest Airlines 747 that was coming in. They were doing some crew training. And the air traffic control provided a clearance to the Cessna 150 and said, "You're cleared to land," which means you've got the approval to fly the approach and land. And the 747, which is doing about 3 times the speed of the Cessna 150 behind, is closing in on the small airplane. And the 747 said, "We would request that go around for the aircraft to allow the Northwest to do the touch and go." And the control tower said, "No, you're number 2 to land." And the pilot called back and basically said, "You know how much it costs for us to do a go around?" And the tower controller said, "No, I don't." He said, $250. And the controller came back and said, they make a $250 turn. You're number two to land on the pattern. So I don't know what it costs per minute or for time, Mr. Chairman. I don't know how true that those numbers are. But I do know that aircraft consume about, on a takeoff, a commercial airliner consumes about 4,000 pounds of fuel an hour for four engines on takeoff or two engines on takeoff. At the price of fuel alone, it's an extremely expensive thing to operate. Mm. When you look, it's an incredibly dynamic industry that is so capital intensive. I mean, you stop to think that to be a competitive airline today, you've got to have somewhere between 300 and 450 commercial airliners in your inventory. The cheapest airliner is $50 to $55 million. The 747s are now pushing $200 million a piece. You've got to have 450 pieces of this equipment to operate and run a business. Mm. And yet we as travelers still expect people to fly anywhere in the United States for under $300 round trip. Cost of fuel, the cost of equipment, the cost of maintaining the system. For every hour in the air, there's like an hour and a half of maintenance on the ground for these aircraft. I mean, it is a phenomenally dynamic and highly volatile industry to operate within. Airports, I have to say, are the most stable economic part of that model, because airlines will always need terminal buildings and runways, and we always get to charge them for those services.
Well, thank you, Mr. Hamill, for your presentation on the Metropolitan Airport Commission. Representative Hornstein, did you have a comment?
A few questions, Mr. Chair, if that's
please.
Okay.
Pepper away.
Always a few from me. Thank you for coming and for your work. We talked a week ago about the crumbling infrastructure in our pavement and our roads, and I have concerns about just air traffic infrastructure in our country. And I know that we've had a few well-publicized near misses at MSP. I know those aren't MAC issues, those are FAA issues. But I'm wondering if you have concerns or thoughts about, I think, a real archaic infrastructure we have for air traffic control in this country. I think that... both in terms of the equipment, the radar equipment, and the lack of personnel. I think our numbers are not that much higher, if not lower, than after the PATCO or before the PATCO strike in the early 1980s. How do you address that issue? What's the interface between MAC and the FAA? Do you have concerns? Obviously, God forbid, if there was an incident, then that becomes a MAC problem because of emergency response and everything else. So I'm wondering your thoughts on that issue, because I don't recall near misses at MSP until the recent couple of years, at least that were publicized. So,
Mr. Hamm.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hornstein, we had one incident just recently that was of significant concern. It was a communication failure on the part of the controllers to the pilot. And it, like anything that happens in aviation, it could have been a catastrophic event. The reality is that we have historically had a couple of events over the course of time that could have been catastrophic, that because of good fortune and timing and so forth did not result in anything unfortunate happening. But let's be very frank here. Inherent in aviation, there's a certain element of risk that we all assume, just like the risk you assume when you get into your car. And while it's a complicated system, air transportation system is a very complicated, very controlled system. In the Twin Cities metro area, everybody is on radar. Everybody who flies into MSP has got to be under air traffic control guidance. Air traffic control guidance means that they're told what airspeed, what altitude, and what direction they head. And the pilots cannot fly on their own volition unless they're cleared to do so by the air traffic controllers. Controllers line aircraft up and with proper spacing, drive by the Minneapolis St. Paul Airport any clear night and take a look around 7 o'clock at night of all the lights, the headlights going out for 4 or 5 or 6 or 7 airplanes. The control system works to line aircraft up to guarantee separation so the aircraft have the time to land and taxi off the runway before the next airplane needs to land on the runway behind them. However, what you point to is the fact that the system that we currently operate under is old. It works well. It has worked well for many, many decades, but it does need to be upgraded. And at the present time, the U.S. Congress and the FAA and the U.S. Transportation Department are all working on a concept called Next Gen, the next generation of air traffic control. And what we're doing basically is transforming slowly, and we need additional budget authorizations to do this. When I say we, meaning that the airports and the airlines of the United States are all working toward improving this system by using advanced technology. So that not only do we have air traffic controllers with eyes and ears and a radar screen, we also have equipment on board and through system satellite systems communicating one another so that we know where airplanes are. And in fact, a pilot in the cockpit today with the new equipment can look at that presentation and see the conflicting aircraft on his pattern and his his path to make certain he's aware of any potential problem. In fact, the near miss that you talk about that occurred about 2 months ago off the end of our parallel runways in Minneapolis, the U.S. aircraft actually saw and received the warning of the other aircraft in a conflict position, and they took evasive action and pulled up aggressively one over the top of the other airplane. It was close, but basically it was the onboard warning systems that are just the beginning steps of that new technology were what prevented that thing from becoming a more serious consequence. So the money's being spent. It's tens of billions of dollars over the course of the next 15 or 20 years, but it's replacing radar systems, onboard aircraft systems, satellite systems all talking to one another, permitting aircraft the opportunity to better navigate through the airspace. As several of you know, I flew in the military for 30 years, and I flew to Minneapolis-St. Paul for 20 of those 30 years. And so up until almost the year 2000, I used the system at least once or twice a week for all those years. And I have to say that the whole system, I've flown all over the world, and there are places where you simply don't want to rely on air traffic control. But the European system, the North American system, the United States, Canada, it's quite frankly quite amazing the way they are able to separate traffic. And I mean, there are literally tens of thousands of flights every day, and you know, it's an occasional unfortunate headline news item that we see where something has happened. But as I say to people, and I don't do it publicly very often because I don't like to say it in front of a group of citizens, this is a little bit different. If there's one thing that I actually worry about, it's not worrying about the staff, worrying about our finances, worrying about the management and operation of our airport system. When I go home at night, the only thing I actually worry about is the possibility of something happening on the airport that would result in casualties and losses. A landing accident where the aircraft doesn't stop in time and goes off the end and catches fire and we have a serious problem. An aircraft that has a mechanical problem that results in some sort of a crash on the airport, or just a departure consequence where an aircraft crashes on takeoff. That's the thing that I worry about most often, because the reality is that no matter how hard we all work at the airport and no matter how hard the mechanics work, airplanes are pieces of machinery. It's like your car. And every once in a while you're driving down the highway and a red light comes on and something's wrong. And we all know that's going to happen. So we have to spend the time being prepared, and we are. That's why we have our own fire department, our own police department. They're highly skilled and trained professionals. We have mutual aid to respond, to help one another in case something does happen. That's part of the safety of the system. Having said that, I should point out to you, and I'm knocking on wood, that we are, I think, one of only two large hub airports in the United States that have not had a major crash on the airport in over 60 years. So our systems seem to work, even though we're in a northern environment with snow and ice and drizzle and freezing rain. It works well, and I think that our reputation is recognized around the country and around the world.
Follow up, Representative Hornstein.
Thank you. Just and then the question I always ask you, but I think it's a little different this year. You have a new chair. We have a new administration. And so I'm wondering if you have new ideas around some of the issues that we've talked about over the years around noise and noise-impacted areas, as well as, I think, some significant environmental issues that the airport is a nexus for around air quality and energy usage. Do you have some new ideas on that with this new administration coming in? 'Cause we're very... we're hopeful that it could potentially be a new chapter in our relationship with the airport, and wanted to see if you had any thoughts initially about those concerns.
Mr. Hamill?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hornstein, I believe that we're still staying the course from the standpoint that we have now spent somewhere approaching $450 million on mitigation of noise in the residential communities around the airport. And I know that you've heard this many times, but I'll say it for the sake of the committee, and that is, to the best of my knowledge, and I think I know pretty well what's going on, not only in the United States, but around the world when it comes to environmental programs, I don't believe that there's any other airport in the world, certainly in the United States, that has spent more money per capita on noise mitigation than the Metropolitan Airports Commission here in the Twin Cities. When we finish this program, we still have another 2 years to go, 3 years to go, 2014, we will have mitigated noise on almost 12,000 residential units in the Twin Cities metropolitan area, We have already acoustically treated 17 schools within what's called the DNL 65 noise contour. In other words, the noise exposure area defined by the federal government is called the 65 DNL contour. At the present time, all of the homes and all the schools that are within that radius have been environmentally mitigated. Only if the homeowner rejected or refused to have that service did we not do that property. We're now beyond the 65 contract to the 60 DNL contour, which makes us eligible for no federal funding whatsoever. We have to take this money out of our back pocket, and we are doing mitigation outside of the 65 federal guideline as well, up to the 60. Now, another thing you need to remember is that every 5 decibels, when you go from 75 to 70, that's cutting the noise in half. From 70 to 65 cuts the noise in half again. From 65 to 60 cuts the noise in half again. It's logarithmic. It's not linear. So when we talk about going out another 5 decibels voluntarily to reduce noise in the communities, we're spending a great deal of time and money trying to help people so that, in fact, they don't experience disruptions when they're inside their home. The practical reality is, and I say this all the time, windows closed, doors closed in your house, acoustically mitigated. You can watch television, talk on a phone, have a conversation, and not be significantly interrupted. Open the windows, go outside and walk around the block. The aircraft are still there. But to our good fortune, airplanes are becoming significantly quieter. We've been very aggressive talking with the airline companies and manufacturers about acoustical treatment to airplanes, the new design technologies, and applying technologies to those aircraft designs. The newer the airplane, the quieter the airplane emission, the lower the fuel emissions. So we see a continued improvement on the environmental front from the standpoint of aircraft operations. I don't know if we'll get to the point where we have stealth commercial airliners. The technology is, in fact, there. The military applies that technology today, but it's very expensive. But at the end of the day, the airport today is quieter than it has been since the mid-1960s because of two things. Acoustical treatment in the community helps the homeowner. But within the airspace, airplanes have become much quieter, and the fact is our operations are down significantly from 2005, which was our peak all-time year, just by virtue of mergers, acquisitions, and our tough economy. It will take us through 2013 and 2014 to begin to come back to where we were previously. We don't expect to be at the levels of 2005 until 2019, 2020. And we believe that by that time, the new technology airplanes that will be coming off the production lines will be even quieter yet. So from an environmental standpoint, as far as noise goes, we will continue to be very, very judicious with that program. We will do our very best to maintain and mitigate. But we are probably not looking at spending hundreds of millions of dollars more at this point beyond the 60 DNL contour. We are, however, paying very close attention to air quality issues and to water quality issues. And water quality is particularly interesting for us and important for us right now because the airport sits between the Minnesota and the Mississippi rivers. So whatever runs off of our concrete ramp surfaces and our runways, we capture that. And then we funnel that to 3 1-million-gallon holding ponds where we then pump it or transport it to the Waste Control Commission for proper environmental treatment. But we need to be prepared to capture as much as we possibly can. So we're constantly looking at ways to improve our water treatment or water quality issues to prevent those flues from getting into the Minnesota or Mississippi rivers. I'll just make a commitment that we'll continue to stay on top of environmental issues. We'll continue to be a leader. And we'll continue to work with the communities if new ideas and new technologies come available.
One last quick one.
Representative Hornstein.
I promise. Just a variety of issues I'm raising here, so this isn't an environmental
Representative
one.
Representative Hornstein, you've always been noted for being brief. Mr. Hamill is very thorough in his answers.
And not brief either.
I'm not sure what that means. we've been looking at, in this committee, the issue of disadvantaged business enterprises with MnDOT and to some extent the Met Council. And I know you've had an awful lot of construction at the site over the last decade, and I think more is anticipated. How does the MAC handle that particular issue, and are you looking at ways in which there could be more inclusion of DBEs and jobs? The jobs that they can provide. I know that there's federal guidelines around minority and women hiring, and I'm wondering how much that is a conversation at the MAC as well.
It's an ongoing and a regular issue. In fact, we look at diversity of our own work staff, our own staff of the commission. This is an industry of predominantly gray-haired white males, and we recognize that. We're sensitive to that, and it's changing, but it's changing slowly. So we're looking for ways of diversifying our own staff from the standpoint of hiring of staff at the Airports Commission. We build into our contract processes our requirements for contractors, for example, to have participation of DB businesses when it's appropriate on projects on the airport. And it's a whole variety from planning and architectural work to construction jobs and so forth, top to bottom. And we also are looking at, we also require in our contracts for concessionaires and so forth in the terminal building that they include opportunities for protected classes. So we look at ourselves, we look at the contracts that we issue, and we look at the services offered in the terminal building as ways of improving and competitively encouraging DVE enterprise opportunities in our facilities.
Thank you. I'm done.
Okay, Representative Benson.
Oh, mine's short, too. I still love to fly. I know it's become more challenging since 2001. I still look forward to opportunities to get on a flight. And I love Minneapolis, St. Paul Airport, too. But as a good conservative Republican, I like the idea, of course, that people pay their freight. So my question, though, and I'm not looking for a long answer, is just maybe a yes or no that you've begun to think about it. And in 20 years, maybe neither one of us will even care. But that's what I think it will probably take that long before we realize, not necessarily my dream, but others, in terms of high-speed rail. And high-speed rail is completely different from the airline industry in that it is absolutely highly subsidized, at least so far. And I'm wondering if you've contemplated what impact that might have on your industry. Economies of scale being what they are, you need to pack a lot of people in that airport in order to pay the freight. So have you given that any thought?
Mr. Hamill?
I'd love to say yes or no. yes and no.
Okay.
Yes, we have. One of our previous commissions, one of our chairmen a couple of commissions ago, was a very staunch advocate of high-speed rail and wanted to see maglev Minneapolis to Rochester and distribute traffic so that, in fact, folks could depart from the Rochester airport and connect, you know, at the same amount of time it would take you to walk from one end of our building to the other. That proved, we took a close look, I wouldn't say a serious scrutinizing look, and not a real analysis, but we took a look just at how that would work, and that didn't seem to be a very viable model, and that would have been part of the link to Chicago sort of a thing, but that was maglev technology, which is extraordinarily expensive. The point being that we have looked at rail in the past. We do view our airport as being a multimodal destination point or opportunity. We have the LRT, we have bus transportation services. All the modes are there except for rail, and we believe that in the future there may very well be an opportunity for heavy rail or long-distance rail. I say yes, we have looked at it, but the reality is that no, we've not looked at it seriously enough to really consider it. We do not consider rail to be a serious threat to air transportation, only because getting to Chicago, which is our most direct and our most popular destination point, Minneapolis-Chicago is our busiest route. The alternative is a 45 to 50-minute flight, or a 4 or 5 hour ride by rail, depending on your needs how much time you're willing to dedicate to the rail commitment. We don't believe that's going to be a serious impediment for the airport. In fact, we just finished our long-term comprehensive plan. We're projecting that the current 33 million passengers a year at the airport will grow to 55 million passengers by 2030, just 20 years away, about a million people a year in increased activity. That projection is based on all modes of travel and demand for travel services and so forth. And while rail isn't specifically identified as a competitor, we believe that, you know, that the 2.5 to 3% growth per year, which has been historically our growth rate, will continue.
Representative Benson,
I just want to shut.
Stepped out there yet?
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. since I am a representative from the Rochester area, I'd have to say I love my airport too. And my concern is whether or not that study showed that we would have to more or less get rid of our airport in order to accommodate the high-speed rail. Would it siphon off those passengers who might otherwise get on an airplane to Rochester and fly up to Minneapolis?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Benson, I don't think that's a serious threat at all. If there was a rail connect between Rochester and Minneapolis, and even went airport to airport for that matter, your passengers who might fly up to Minneapolis to catch a flight and then go to their ultimate destination, they may be impacted and have a choice. A lot of those people at the present time just drive. The reality is that you've got pretty good traffic distribution to Denver, to Chicago, and other points. Mr. Leckie's done a very, very nice job down there of managing that airport. It's a very, very nice airport. It can accommodate any kind of or size of aircraft operation other than the huge airplanes. And I just don't think that Minneapolis-St. Paul is going to take anything away from Rochester. If anything, we kind of complement one another, and we do actually work together.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, Mr. Hamill, as part of the behalf of the committee, for coming and explaining a little bit about the Metropolitan Airport Commission to us. We know that you don't have to bring your budget back before us. At some point, maybe we just want to hear from you again, just because we admire the job you're doing over there. But we're about to start into our transportation budget now. So, again, members, any other quick questions? Seeing none, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much for the opportunity. Let me offer a thought, and that is that at a more environmentally compatible time of the year, I'd like to invite the committee to come on out to the airport and take a tour of the facilities. I think everyone who comes out really does learn a great deal, and they enjoy the opportunity. And so I'd please like to have you put that on your calendar for some future opportunity. Thanks for your time today. I know that we were supposed to be up last week. I was pleased that we were deferred because it gave us more time today. I'm sorry for talking so much, but it's a great story, and you need to hear it, I think. So thank you very much for your time.
You are welcome. Members, Ms. Zuers has this two-page handout front and back on governor's recommendations for the transportation budget. These are change items that are under our jurisdiction. Ms. Zuers, would you like to take a moment to explain that to us? I'm sure you pull your microphone up there and
follow along. Mr. Chair and members, just a real brief overview of the governor's recommendations from the two-pager. As you can see, the governor recommended a total transportation budget of $4.7 billion for the biennium. This is $270 million above the previous biennium, and a lot of that increase is due to increases in federal funds and also the gas tax and tab fee phase-in changes from the 2008 legislative session in Chapter 152. The governor's budget also recommends a $16.4 million decrease in general fund spending in comparison to the base appropriations. This is about a 9% reduction in the base appropriations. Just a real brief overview of the chart in the middle of the page. As you can see, the Department of Transportation, the governor recommended an 8% decrease in the general fund budget in comparison to base. This is also is a 3% change in comparison, a 3% increase in comparison to the previous biennium. And with the Metropolitan Council, the governor recommended an 8% reduction in comparison to base. This is a 1% reduction in comparison to the previous biennium. One important note on the Department of Public Safety, the 17% reduction is actually a shift in spending. Currently, we spend $2.7 million per biennium on health care benefits. It's health insurance coverage for peace officers and firefighters who were injured in the line of duty, and this spending will, with the governor's recommendations, would come out of the fire safety account instead of the general fund. So even though it looks like a 17% reduction, it's a 17% reduction in our budget. The fire safety account is in the Public Safety Committee's jurisdiction. And the rest of the two-pager gets into the detailed change items, the governor's recommendations.
Ms. Zuers, would you remind the committee why, let's just take the DOT's 30.7 million dollar number. Why was the forecast base supposed to jump almost $4 million? Was that from MVEST and sales tax money coming into that fund that's to be spent as general fund money, or why did we see a $4 million increase roughly?
Mr. Chair and members, the difference between the 10-11 biennium and then the forecast base for 12-13 is that the legislature for fiscal year 2011 made some reductions in order to meet its target last legislative session for transit. And so, but they were one-time reductions for fiscal year 2011.
So those were to be restored then?
Mr. Chair, yes.
Bounce back. Thank you. Representative Hornstein, you had a question.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and Ms. Zuers. I know we're going to have the Met Council in here on Wednesday to really go over their budget and how they anticipate addressing this 9% reduction. But you have in your memo that to help mitigate this issue, the council may implement a fare increase of 25 cents. Is that, I haven't heard that. I mean, is that something that they've communicated with you? Maybe it's been out there and I'm not aware of it, but is that, or is that from a past way that they were dealing with past deficits? I'm wondering where that 25 cents comes from.
Ms. Zuers?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hornstein, that was a figure noted in the budget pages provided by the Met Council.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you. Does that kind of bring us up to speed on where we're at the moment? Members, any further questions or anything? MICA, anything else we need to make them aware of before we adjourn for the day? Members, thank you for your attention today. I look forward to seeing you in the basement hearing room on Wednesday. Meeting is adjourned.